This podcast is brought to you by BMJ Best Practice. BMJ Best Practice offers evidence-based, continually updated, and practical knowledge that will help you make better clinical decisions.
Hello and welcome to this latest podcast on infectious disease. Kieran Walsh is my name. I'm Clinical Director at BMJ. This podcast is on Eastern Equine Encephalitis Virus. Humans infected with this virus may be asymptomatic or may have flu-like symptoms, or they may develop encephalitis. The mortality for people with neuroinvasive disease is up to 30 to 50%, so this is a very serious disease. And to help advise us, we have on the line Professor Steve Schechtschneider. Steve is Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at the University of Arkansas College of Medicine. So Steve, you're welcome. The first question is, what exactly is this disease?
Well, it's a viral infection that, as you mentioned earlier, may progress to generalized involvement of the central nervous system in very severe cases, as in one we reported as the first one in our own state a few years ago in the recorded history. They may present with fever, mental status changes, seizures, and ultimately catastrophic complications like cerebral edema that is responsible for the mortality associated with it that you described.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, you've started to answer the next question already, which is about recognition of an affected patient. Besides those symptoms, any other symptoms or signs you should look for?
I think one should always be concerned about the encephalitis when you have findings of fever, headache, and mental status changes. The hallmark of encephalitis early on remains personality changes, and although these are very difficult to detect clinically, the questions to the family often will bring out such a change. It may be that a very easygoing individual has become very difficult, or vice versa. And I believe families generally always can give us some information that represents some degree of a personality change.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. And if you do suspect the disease clinically, what tests should you request?
Well, ultimately, while there are a number of serum markers that can be looked at, I believe your diagnosis is going to be best supported by lumbar puncture with examination of the cerebral spinal fluid. Depending on which particular virus you're talking about, you can frequently see a pleocytosis. The type of cell may vary, although it may be typical of viral process such as a lymphocytic or mononuclear infiltration in the CSF. The other thing that is fairly consistent would be to have an elevation of the protein in the spinal fluid, so a hyperproteinemia in the spinal fluid. Additionally, other testing in the availability of MR has been a big asset in seeing more subtle brain changes than we were previously able to see with just computed tomography.
Okay, great. Thank you. And what about management and treatment? What's the mainstay of treatment?
For the most part, it's supportive care. Depending on the particular virus, and in the case of Eastern equine encephalitis, there are not great specific therapies as of yet. So the hallmark remains supportive care, and in severe cases, admission to a intensive care unit for management of intracranial hypertension and other generalized supportive care that one would provide to any critically ill patient.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's very helpful. And in terms of non-drug management or non-medical management, are isolation measures necessary? Can people spread the virus?
This is not from human-to-human contact in general. We suspect in the index case that we reported a few years back, it's actually a mosquito vector through a mosquito biting an infected horse, hence the name equine encephalitis. That particular year, there were a number of equine deaths in our state from this disease. But this was the first reported human transmission. There had been six deaths of horses in the area within approximately 15 to 20 miles of where this individual lived.
So just to be explicit, humans can't spread the disease to other humans?
Not in terms of human-to-human transmission that we understand.
Okay, great. But I guess you should check in the history for exposure to horses or other animals. Is that correct?
Well, you would need to have infected horses, but because it's a mosquito transmission in general, that there may not be any awareness, as was in the case with us. It's simply because it is one of the viruses that we look for in our viral meningoencephalitis panel that we found it.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. And I'm guessing that this is a reportable disease. Is that correct? Should you notify the relevant authorities?
I believe in most locales it will be. That would vary by state and national regulation, but in our own state, it is absolutely reportable in terms of understanding the changing transmission patterns. There is some concern that climate change may be impacting the where this disease is seen. And so with any unusual infection, that becomes very important. So the epidemiology can be considered completely.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. Let's move on to differential diagnosis next. What are the differential diagnoses of Eastern equine encephalitis virus?
Probably the most important immediate one would be to ensure that you're not dealing with bacterial meningitis, because of the presentations can be very similar, but bacterial meningitis in general is going to have a much more fulminant course. And obviously, we do have effective antibiotics for that. So if the index of suspicion, and in many cases, these patients are going to be treated with appropriate antibiotics to cover the central nervous system, such as ceftriaxone and vancomycin.
Okay. Thank you. That's great. That's helpful. And what about pitfalls in diagnosis and indeed management of the disease? Are there any common pitfalls?
I think probably the biggest one is to not have a wide enough differential. There are many, many viruses that cause central nervous system infection and inflammation. And many of those we still do not have effective testing for. We now, with molecular techniques, do have the ability to detect a number of viruses very rapidly. But unfortunately, for many of the more uncommon causes of encephalitis, like Eastern equine, those tests are not widely available and, for the most part, are research tests done by very specialized laboratories.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. What have we missed so far? Are there any other questions you typically get asked about this disease, and what are the answers to those questions?
Well, I think having a broad team involved in the care of a patient when you suspect encephalitis is very helpful, no matter what the cause of. In the case of a severely ill patient, a critical care specialist, as well as an infectious disease specialist, and potentially a neurologist or neurosurgeon, is quite helpful. in our case, a neurosurgeon was clearly an important part of helping us manage intracranial pressure, although we were ultimately not able to control it with the ultimate demise of the patient.
Okay, thank you. And in terms of the team, who else should be on the team?
In patients who do survive, ultimately, they will need a physiatrist or physical medicine specialist in terms of their potential for rehab. Sometimes these patients can have very devastating neurologic sequelae, and so doing things to maximize their outcome is important for patients who do survive such a devastating illness.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And last question. If you had one single piece of advice to give to a doctor or other healthcare professional about the disease, I wonder what would it be?
I think the point about having a broad differential is very important. If you don't have a explanation for what is going on in a patient clearly with a neurologic problem, continuing to search for the answer, as well as involving an ever-increasing circle of consultants in helping to complete that search, is really important.
Okay. Thank you very much, Steve, and thanks to you all for listening. We hope that this has been helpful, and we hope that you'll be able to put what you've learned into action to better recognize, report, and refer affected patients. If you want to find out more, click the link in the podcast to sign into BMJ Best Practice and BMJ Learning and look at the content on this and other serious infectious diseases. Thank you once again. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes.